50,000 Americans dying a month, disappearing after they come out of meetings. That's, of course, what we lost in more than 15 years of Vietnam. And so they were losing monthly, not in combat, but to the depredations of the death squads, what we lost in 15 years of Vietnam. And so I came to understand much better that they had resorted to violence to defend themselves, really out of survival, more than anything else. So it's interesting because when I see the question that we've asked, or that is being asked, should the Unitarian Universalist Association reject the use of any and all kinds of violence and war to resolve disputes between peoples and nations? I know that some people think that that question makes us a peace church, may make us pacifist, which is something that people sometimes, I think, don't quite understand and think may imply some kind of pacifism. But in fact, I don't think that statement says anything about not defending yourself. I don't think it says anything. It says the rejection of the use of any and all kinds of violence to resolve disputes. But I think that's probably a slightly different question than would we not have an army, say, to defend ourselves until such time in the world it was not necessary. Or I don't think that's a utopian question. I think it's a question of someplace like we would like to move toward, understanding that we in the world are a long ways away from there, even at this point. So I think that I find in discussions I've had casually that I find many people actually impute to that question characteristics that are not necessarily a part of that, part of the question. So I think this is a very useful series of discussions that we're engaging in congregations and in our churches and in institutions like USC. And I'm very happy to be part of this call and would be very happy to spend the rest of the call perhaps answering some questions or hearing some of your own points of view, if you'll keep them stated briefly. I think that's probably a sufficient kind of introduction to the question.
Charlie, this is Mac. The issue currently in Burma and Myanmar, how much should we do to get more aid to the people there? I mean, roughly still one-third or two-thirds of the people have still not seen any aid at all.
How much? You know, Mac, I think that's a very good question, and I think that some of the next steps in the evolution of the United Nations refer to what the United Nations calls Chapter 7 authority or not. So the new peacekeepers that have been deployed in Darfur since January 1st are deployed with Chapter 7 authority, meaning they're actually authorized to use violence to defend civilians there. Whereas the African Union peacekeepers who were there previously did not have that authority. So they were there actually to protect and monitor peacekeepers, but they had no authority to protect civilians. So often they actually witnessed the Janjaweed doing some of the things they were doing, but had to stand by mutely. I think that the authority of the United Nations to use Chapter 7 authority has been limited in the world. And one of the problems is that the UN forces themselves have to be seconded from other nations, and they don't have any force of their own. And the question is, really revolves to, is there a moral authority that allows us to use violence to defend people who may be the victims of a genocide, which is happening in Darfur, and one could say maybe a slow motion affair in Burma. And I think the great notions that the world is wrestling with today are those notions of the whole idea of sovereignty, first introduced by John Locke, which gave the authority to the sovereign of a nation to use violence against his or her own constituents, and really to be almost impossible to hold accountable until the notions of human rights came about, largely with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, and the evolution of the series of conventions and treaties that flowed from the Universal Declaration. One of those was the Convention to Ban Genocide. Another of those was the Convention to Ban Torture. Another as a Convention to Ban Landmines. These conventions or treaties, when signed and ratified by 60 nations, they entered force as international law. And after 10 years, if they're generally being abided by, become customary international law, whether people sign them or not. And so I think that we have not evolved to the state where the United Nations has forces that are capable of its own, and so the UN has to authorize nations to take these actions, like it did in the first Gulf War when it authorized a collection of forces put together, led by the United States, to use force to remove Kuwait, remove the Iraq army from Kuwait. And I think that we have seen in Zimbabwe, certainly by almost every definition, crimes against humanity committed by Robert Mugabe there. And I think that what the military junta has done in Burma today could be considered crimes against humanity for not allowing aid in there. But we as a world community are very, very hesitant to actually use armed intervention in the name of humanitarianism, even when the stakes are genocide. I don't know if that answers your question. Mac, would you like to have a follow-up?
No, I think that's very good. I mean, the whole issue to me
follow-up question,
right now
Judy.
Is this issue of hunger, and with the prices of food going where it is, going to be a lot of hunger.
Judy, would you like to go ahead?
Follow-up question? Yeah, a follow-up to that. In terms of humanitarian intervention, is there a lot of thought about what are nonviolent approaches to humanitarian interventions that wouldn't require a military force? Is there a lot of work being done on that?
I think there is a large body of work that has been done on that and is being done by it, and I think that these are the issues that Sharon Welch is very well versed in and can speak to. I think that the dilemma is that they need to be enacted fairly early, because when a conflict reaches the stage of Darfur, I think one of the concerns is that although the peacekeepers are authorized to use force, most of them are not seconded with the idea that they will be involved in something short of war, and when the conflict is escalated to the level that it is today, it's very hard to imagine the Janjaweed there not taking on some of those peacekeepers in some circumstances. And so I think that the nonviolent forms of intervention are forms that really lend themselves to an earlier stage of engagement. I think there's some very interesting questions to be looked back upon, because the standard against which all this is measured is often used as Nazi Germany, and people say, well, but Hitler had been stopped with anything short of violence. There are some very interesting examples of nonviolence being used within the Nazi era, and one of them took place in the middle of the war, actually in Berlin, where the government rounded up the husbands of a number of women who were non-Jewish, married to Jewish men, and those women protested every day and held kind of a silent vigil in a place called Rosenstrasse in Berlin for almost a month, and the Third Reich somehow backed down and allowed those people to go on living in Berlin and did not deport them to the death camps in the face of that kind of nonviolent public witness. There are a few other examples, but I think that that's often the litmus test. We're often said, well, would nonviolence have stopped the Nazis? Well, when World War II was already underway, it probably would have been more difficult. Had those measures been used early on, it certainly might have been possible to turn the tide of Nazism.
Yeah, Charlie?
Yes.
This is Vicki Weeks from Savannah. And I liked your point about that this CSAI is not necessarily intended as a pacifist, total peace church statement, in that it isn't specifically calling for no ultimate use of force in self-defense. I think in looking at it that way, it allows us to start moving toward developing proactive solutions. One of the things that I've been following all of the discussion on the peacemaking board, and everything continues to be reactive when, as we look at the causes of violence, all war to me appears to be a matter of economic resource. It is always about economics, and it is about the production in this country by such an extensive part of the economy of some element of the military-industrial complex production of weapons or research and development or supplies, or and so that in the Quebec City GA, I had put forward a CSAI that was voted, it was not voted into being, but it was about not using any foreign aid money to research, develop, deploy any weapons or munitions. And at what point are we going to start recognizing the impact of the weapons and military-industrial complex and its extent into the employment sectors of our country on the continuation of warfare worldwide?
Well, I think it's a very important point, and I would actually start someplace even further up the food chain, so to speak, and that is if we are to seriously answer this question, I think it will involve what I would consider self-disclosure, in that we live with a lot of myths about ourselves, and as long as we continue to believe those myths and act as if they're the truth, I think it obscures from us part of the solution to this question that's been asked, and that is that we are an extremely violent nation. We have been born in violence, and I don't just mean the violence of the American Revolution, but I mean the violence with which we progressively and systematically removed Native Americans from their land and made treaty after treaty with them and broke them and then took their lands and then made more treaties and then broke them. The violence that was inherent in every part of slavery and its use to build this nation, the violence that has been such a part of our culture, our machismo, if you will, that has produced a violence toward women that is almost accepted every place. And so I really think before we can even get at these larger issues, we need to come face to face with some of our founding myths that we live with, and that we are the good guys, that we were the white hats, we are the nation of kind of do-gooders, and there are evil empires out there that we would challenge and take on and use our military might to stand up to, when in fact part of the myth is that we have become the number one arms salesman in the world, and probably one of the nations that exports more violence in terms of its military assistance, and we use that. And so, you know, I think there were 80 nations whose military assistance was threatened to be cut off if they dared to sign and ratify the International Criminal Court Convention, the treaty that established the International Criminal Court, a place where those that commit war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide could be adjudicated, something we've long stood for. We actually threatened military aid of 80 nations if they actually voted for that. So it's fascinating to see how we wield violence and threats of it ourselves. And I think you're right that
you sort of made my whole point was there was the Revolutionary War, and there it was taxation without representation, the economic impetus, the Indians, we wanted their land. I mean, you know, it's all about resource utilization and economics. And as we go forward with the perils of global warming and the fact that we have armed so much of the world, the CSAI is, sure, it's a great thing, and it's a good discussion of just versus a just war versus pacifism. But I mean, I think we're moving to a point where all of this global tipping point issues, we're not at just peak oil, we're at peak resources, we're at peak water. We're, you know, that the CSAI, as we go forward, needs to start becoming proactive with regard to addressing the underlying economic issues. And in this country, when you look at our GDP, our military budget, our Defense Department budget, and even just something as small as the foreign aid budget, how many American jobs are impacted were we to decrease weapons and munitions funding? But it's something that we've got to start attacking and addressing. Or I don't see how we end the problem. You know, there has to be a transitioning to a peace economy. And it seems to me that has to become the largest part of our discussion.
Well, I think that your emphasis on the underlying economics, I think, will be borne out in practically every war that has been taking place, although we use other euphemisms to certainly obscure that, and,
right,
and to justify it. And I think that it is part of this, what I call this underlying national myth, that all many nations have these kind of myths. You know, another of our myths is that we're not racist, that we're very a very tolerant nation, and that we we have, you know, we were one of the first nations to promote civil liberties per se, and yet that deeper examination would belie that national myth.
So is this, if this moves into the next phase then of approval and development, how do we input toward the development of policies, actions, and materials and resource guides that address the true issues, which are the underlying economic issues that are being obscured by myth?
Well, I think that's a very fundamental question, and I think that part of it, as I said, lies in taking on this national myth about how we are and how we perceive ourselves and how we define ourselves in relation to the rest of the world, but even that myth within America, because certainly the growing chasm between the rich and the poor in this country, I think, is a form of violence, and we enact more and more laws to you know, protect the assets of those who have and make it more and more difficult for those that don't to play on this playing field. And so I think a lot of it does come down to economics. But
so,
that's a very, very, that last question you asked is a very complex one and probably beyond the scope of this call, but maybe we could make room for a couple of other questions.
Thank you.
Just a reminder to unmute your line. If you want to ask a question, press *6.
You know, I might mention while we're waiting for another question that most of us, if we look at the culture around us, we grew up with this with the myth that kind of glorifies war in the cause of righteousness. I think it's part of our national myth, and so you know, I grew up in the era of John Wayne movies, and I was certainly part of this culture of the military. Who we are asking to defend us today is a reflection of what that last caller was speaking about. We have an all-volunteer military now, and we're not getting enough all volunteers because some of them are having second thoughts about what they're being asked to do in Iraq. So we have created a waiver for mental fitness. We used to require the minimum of a high school degree for young men and women to join the military, or a GED, a high school equivalent. But now we have waivers for that. We have created physical waivers, and so it used to be that you couldn't get in the military had asthma or if you were overweight, but now we have a number of physical waivers, and we now have moral waivers because it used to be that you couldn't get in the military if you had a criminal record and had committed felonies, but now we have moral waivers such that about 1 in 8 young men and women, mostly men joining the military, have criminal records, maybe have prior convictions for drug use or for use of alcohol or even some kinds of felonies. Because we're not getting the sufficient numbers of people that we need, and so although I consider myself someone who's really committed to nonviolence, I'm all in favor of universal service, where everyone would have to serve their country. Let those who would like to be teachers join VISTA, the Peace Corps. Let those who would gravitate toward the military serve in the military. But I think that if everyone in this country had to worry about their sons or daughters serving in Iraq, I think we would have an anti-war movement today. And one of the reasons we don't is because we have allowed kind of what to happen that happened during the Civil War. President Lincoln enacted a law that allowed you to buy someone to serve in your stead. So if you didn't want to serve in the Federal Army for $300, you could pay someone else to do it. Today we have enlistment bonuses of $20,000 called quick ship bonuses. And any young man who's ready to go within 30 days can earn a quick ship bonus And I wonder if we're not just having kind of a more sophisticated form of what President Lincoln enacted during the midst of the Civil War, because very few of us on this call have to worry about our sons or daughters dying in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Hi, Charlie. It's Lori Roshlow. Can you hear me? Hi.
Yes.
I was just wondering, do you think it's a misrepresentation to call Iraq a war? I was listening to Jimmy Carter's book, and that was one of the positions he made in the book, because U.S. citizens are not having to make sacrifices. He believes it's a misrepresentation to call that a war.
Well, I think semantics are terribly important. You know, I first learned this, and I didn't even understand it at the time, but in his book, Markings, Dag Hammarskjöld says that that words imply moral categories, and so we must choose them carefully. And I didn't really understand that at the time, but I wrote it down and carried it around in my diary for years. But I think that's the kind of thing he was talking about. Many people say that we should call what's going on in Iraq an occupation rather than a war, because much of the response to our presence is what is prolonging and escalating the violence there. I hadn't read Jimmy Carter's book, but I do think that words imply moral categories, and we have to use them carefully. If we use them in different ways, and certainly we've seen this administration is a master at using words that can kind of convey different things. Certainly, we were led to believe that there was a huge threat to our national security by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they were not there. We were led to believe that that Iraq was a threat to its neighbors, which was not the case when the war began. I was there about 3 weeks before it began, and their army was a wreck after 10 years of sanctions. We were led to believe that they had, of course, weapons of mass destruction and biological weapons, which the UN forces could never uncover evidence of. And so words were used in very damaging ways to persuade the U.S. that we could justify this war, for lack of a better word. But your point is well taken, and I think that one of the things that we can do as people with commitment to nonviolence is to use our language intentionally and carefully. Our language is filled with violence in many ways. I'm sure many of you on the call are familiar with Marshall Rosenberg's kind of seminars and how to use nonviolent language, which is not natural to us in this country.
Thank you.
I ask a question. I have 2 points. One is an observation. I liked what was said so far. And Charlie, when you refer to the United Nations, those myths and their bad use of words is very important, because, as we saw in Rwanda, probably was the worst example. United Nations couldn't act, because who decides when it is genocide, when it is not, when you have to do something you don't, and obviously United Nations would be improved in our country, I guess, is at the origin of many of the facts. The question I have then on the other, going back to the EU Association and now ESAI, what are we going to do about people? Is it true, rather than lots of us, lots of UUs who are not on this call probably, tremble or frown at the idea of nonviolence, of pacifism? They discuss those words, and they use the word war in a glorious way, you know. And I know it's very difficult, and I appreciate what you said about defending, protecting the oppressed and the violence, which is not with weapons, where they are violated and oppressed, and we can defend them and protect them. I appreciate that. But the notion of war, whether it's Jimmy Carter or anybody else, war is an antiquated concept. Disappear, we cannot do that. Because we are used. But what about agreeing, trying to get an agreement that culture, the culture of peace, is what we are aiming at? I understand that's what you feel from what you say, that it takes time. You have to try to lead in that direction. That was my question.
Well, I don't think we should necessarily view the success or failure of this process we've engaged in and will engage in for several years about this vote that takes place in 3 years, because I think the fact that we're doing this is a tremendous success. The all the work that has been, you know, I tried to join the core team for a while. I think I did so for about 3 months. I just couldn't keep up with the volume of all the work that is going on that is so impressive. And so I think that we have achieved an enormous amount already, and the best is yet to come. As we expand, I think, people's understanding of these issues and whether we call it the culture of peace or the culture of nonviolence, you know, expanding our understanding of violence so that people understand how very violent poverty is, how very violent things like racism are, and you know, how young women are emotionally damaged by sexism as a form of violence, and beginning to look around us and see how we have, you know, Mandy Patinkin is this actor who was on a television series called Criminal Minds, and Mandy resigned from the show because the violence on the show was just sickening to him. As an actor who was paid about $75,000 per episode, he talked to the producers and said, "You know, I cannot continue to act in this series when we glorify these criminals who often perpetrate incredible kinds of violence, some of it sexual, against women, and we use this show to ostensibly kind of expose and catch them, but and we're satisfying people's basis needs." And so he resigned finally from this very lucrative position when he couldn't get them, the producers, to amend their ways. But if you look at the amount of television and the topics it suggests, we have a voracious appetite for this, and you're right, the culture of peace would not have that. And so I think that we have achieved a great deal by having this four-year CSAI and what we're involved with, the small group ministries that are involving, the discussions, the books people are reading. It's a slow process and a patient one that you have to understand that the arc of the universe is long, and it does bend towards justice, but it takes people like us bending it to make it happen. And so it will be a slow process, and I don't know how people will vote in the end at that General Assembly on the question, but regardless of how they vote, we've achieved a remarkable amount already.
Yes, I agree. Thank you for saying that.
This is Amy in Montgomery, and I've basically just been listening tonight, but I do have something that just came up, because you're talking about books that we're reading and the discussions and about the myths, and I don't know how I got an email about this book, but it's a book that I just got, and I haven't had a chance to really read it yet. But it's called American Wars, Illusions and Realities, and it's a collection of essays on exactly the questions of myth. I mean, they'll state the myth, and then there's an essay about how it's not true. Like, we fight for peace and democracy is one of the myths, and then there's an essay following that. And it goes through, and I haven't actually read the whole book, but it sounded like it was something... I got it to maybe start a group, a discussion at our church around that, of the myths that we live with and what the reality really is.
Is that book handy that you could name the author for us?
Yeah, well, it's different authors. It's The editor is Paul Buchheit.
Okay.
And it's, I think I got the email because it's published by Clarity Press, and I had bought another book from them about torture. And so I'm like kind of on the list. And so when this one, it's just been published because I've had it just a couple months, so it's just come out. But the name of it is American Wars, Illusions and Realities.
Well, I think something like that is a great place to begin. And there are a number of people who have been writing and speaking about that for some time. I think the one that brought it first to my attention, and I'm having a senior moment here. The author from MIT, who has written so much about American foreign policy and addresses those myths, it's very interesting that how much these are parcel of textbooks of our schools. And so there are initiatives like Facing History and Ourselves, which is an effort that began teaching about the Holocaust and then began teaching really about other kinds of genocide, and it's even evolving further now. And I think it touches about 1 million students a year now in many schools, being introduced curriculums that address these issues. And so one thing that we will have to take on eventually, if we're serious about this work, is kind of demythifying our textbooks, if you will, which will be a huge task.
Yeah, it will be huge.
But thank you for mentioning that book. I think it's a book like that is a great place to begin. I'm not familiar with that one, but we'll probably look into it.
Hi, Charlie. It's Lori Roschlow again. I was just wondering, what are your thoughts about the Department of Peace? There's been proposed legislation, I think, and 3 or 4 different congressional sessions about creating a Department of Peace.
You know, I have mixed emotions about it simply because I've seen how things can be co-opted. And so I think that there were many of us who worked very hard to create a U.S. Institute for Peace maybe 10 or 20 years ago. And if you look at what the U.S. Institute does now, it does fund some studies of nonviolent forms of intervention, but for the most part, the funding that the U.S. government created for the U.S. Institute of Peace, I think, has been undermined by the people who control it and create the agenda. And so I think with the Department of Peace, which is a great idea, my question would be, is how do we protect it from becoming an instrument of the very thing we wish it were not? And I think we can see in this administration, were there a Department of Peace, it would be a tool to probably justify aggression in some bizarre form of doublespeak. So I think I have not mixed feelings about its intent, but how we protect it from the corruption of power, which seems so inevitable sometimes in our government.
Yeah, we might be better off just placing it somewhere else in the world than here.
It might be better off. You know, I think I should mention that I'm a great fan of the nation of Costa Rica and their first president of what they call the modern era, a man called Pepe Figueres, who was the head of the rebel army that took on the army of the state and defeated them in 1947, and he disbanded his own victorious army and disbanded the army of the state as well and created the modern state that said we will live largely without an army. And as a result, getting back to that earlier question about economics, if you look at the standard of living created in Costa Rica over the years, I think it shows what a nation that does not tilt toward militarism can provide, and it has a higher rate of literacy, better indices of health care, and many other attributes of less disparity between the rich and poor in that country than elsewhere, then we have a model of what a Department of Peace might look like in terms of what it could achieve. So there are some interesting examples out there that we can look toward, and we can have initiatives like Facing History, Facing Ourselves that achieve a great deal without having it necessarily come from the government. I think if Facing History and Facing Ourselves had been a government-mandated program, somehow it would end up corrupted and undermined. I sound awfully cynical here. I'm sorry.
Hi.
About our government.
Are you ready for another question?
Yes.
Okay. This is Joe Sipigora from Marstown Unitarian Fellowship. I'm a strong supporter of the Department of Peace, and so I bristled a little bit when I heard your first response, which was how the government can misuse it, and I fully agree with you. I've seen it happen in the last 7 years, but I would like to be more optimistic about it and think about all those other administrations who have used our cabinets well and have served the public very well, and I do believe that there are some functions that we do need the federal government to oversee or at least wield its power. So even though we should be cognizant of how it can be misused, I still think that having a Department of Peace as one component of peacemaking still can be of service, especially with a different administration. So I just needed to throw in that editorial.
Well, I'm glad that you did, and I think that we thought of the U.S. Institute for Peace in that very fashion 20 years ago. We thought this was going to be a great place where we would have funding for nonviolence in schools and for curriculums and for studies and to promote the culture of peace. And you look at how, the board of directors of the U.S. Institute is appointed and who gets appointed and what they do with that money and how much of it goes to what I would consider its true objectives and how much of it goes to fund really almost you could say beltway bandits who are part of that other culture. I would almost call the U.S. Institute of Peace a failure of the dreams of those who created it. And so maybe we can do better with the Department of Peace. But we should probably look at the U.S. Institute of Peace as an example of how badly things can go awry.
This is Larry. You've talked a lot about education, I think, and I think that's really important. But also coming, of course, from a humanitarian organization perspective, advocacy is very much a part of, and of course you're advocating very much that we not accept things at face value in almost any government. So that the continuing role of advocacy, I think, is partially comes up in the peace discussion, the Peace Department issue at this point in time as a cutting edge. I think we just have to find more cutting edges.
I would agree, Larry, and perhaps I should clarify that I am very much a Unitarian Universalist. The nice thing about becoming a UU is you don't have to give up a lot, but at some point in my life I realized that I was much more of a Unitarian Universalist than I was a Quaker, especially in the sense that I kind of accepted in El Salvador that there are times when perhaps even I would use violence, although I was horrified at those circumstances, but I confess that I probably would in certain circumstances. And I think most of you, if you needed to use violence to protect a child, if a child was being attacked by somebody, I doubt if anyone on this call, as committed as we are to nonviolence, would not use force to defend a child if you had to, if that was all that was left. And so at a certain point in time, I came to understand that I was much more a Unitarian Universalist. And one of the things in our tradition that I'm proudest of is that I often say that you use remind me of Tank Man in Tiananmen Square, that man who stood in front of the tank, and when it turned left, he would jump in front of it and block it. When it turned right, he would jump in front of it. And I think that Unitarians and then Universalists and now Unitarian Universalists have been standing in front of this great ship of state of ours for more than 200 years, trying to keep it on a self-correcting course, which of course means a lot of advocacy, Larry, but whether the issue was abolition or whether the issue was women's suffrage or whether the issue was the Holocaust or whether the issue was civil rights or whether the issue was Vietnam or Central America or Iraq or equal marriage or gay rights and lesbian rights and GLBT rights, I think that Unitarians and Universalists have been standing in front of the ship of state trying to keep it on a self-correcting course, and I have no doubts that we will continue to do so. And of course, we do that in a nonviolent way. We don't resort to violence to do that. And so sometimes the false question, the dichotomy, oh, you know, are you committed to violence or nonviolence? Well, of course, we don't resort to violence to do these things that we do. But it's one of the things I'm proudest about of this tradition of ours.
This is Mac, and it's 9 o'clock, so we're gonna stop recording. But if anybody wants to stay on the call, it's perfectly all right. And as long as Charlie wants to stay on, we can stay on.
This is Vicki again, and I was just